1-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Zoe Karina, Eric Galatis, and Farah Siddiqui. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, featuring the Global Citizen International Digest with PSU Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertoff, and I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the past week or so. Here are some of the news items I'll be covering. New restrictions on U.S. investment in China amidst Chinese economic setbacks. Alexei Navalny, Russia's leading dissident, speaks from prison. And U.S.-China science agreement is in danger. New restrictions on U.S. investment in China. The Biden administration is imposing restrictions on financial movements into China. For now, the restrictions will be on private equity and venture capital firms that invest in Chinese companies working on semiconductors, AI, and quantum computing, areas that may have military applications. Until now, those firms have been able to invest at will, in contrast with direct investments by multinational corporations. Now, they will have to report their financial activities to the U.S. government. Restricting foreign investment is standard procedure for many governments, including China. But these restrictions by Biden, in the context of worsening ties with China, adds to the political tensions, even though U.S. investments in China are a drop in the bucket, about 5% of total foreign investment in China. No doubt, especially upsetting for Chinese officials, is that these investment restrictions come amidst continuing bad news for China's economy, which now appears to be facing deflation, falling prices amidst stagnant domestic demand for goods, a collapsing real estate market, declining exports and imports, and very high government debt. What we need to keep in mind, however, is that China's economic woes are a global problem. Its economy represents around 22% of global economic growth, which means a dramatic slowdown will adversely affect other economies' trade, investment, and consumerism. The challenge for China is to make the transition, like other wealthy economies have, from export-led growth to consumer demand growth. The challenge for the U.S. is not to gloat or be seen as exacerbating China's decline, which it is doing right now. President Biden said China is, quote, a ticking time bomb. When bad folks have problems, they do bad things. Not the right attitude, nor are investment and export restrictions the right response. Alexei Navalny speaks. Russia's most famous current dissident, Alexei Navalny, has received yet another prison sentence, this time of 19 years, for extremism. He's already serving time for the very same charge. Navalny was able to get out his latest appeal, called My Fears and Hatred, on August 11. In it, he offers a blistering critique of the Russian ruling class, not just Putin's regime, but also Boris Yeltsin's, and people in civil society who, he says, sold, drank away, wasted the historic chance our country had at the beginning of the 1990s, when the Soviet Union ceased to exist and democratic development seemed at hand. I hate swindlers, Navalny says, whom we for some reason called reformers. Now it's crystal clear that they did nothing but scheming and thought solely about their own wealth. Are there other countries where so many ministers of reformist governments became millionaires and billionaires, he asks. I hate the authors of the most stupid authoritarian constitution, which was cheaply sold to us idiots as a democratic one, handing the president powers of an absolute monarch from the outset. In short, he says, finally, I hate everyone from the leadership of Russia, who after the 1991 coup and the 1993 shelling of the parliament building had full-fledged powers, but didn't even try to carry out democratic reforms. The U.S.-China science agreement is in danger. If there's one area of U.S.-China relations that has been mutually beneficial, it's scientific cooperation. In 1979, when U.S.-China relations were officially normalized, the very first agreement was on scientific cooperation. By the time the agreement was renewed in 2011, scientific cooperation had expanded dramatically to include agricultural science, high-energy physics, clean energy, and biomedical research. Now, the U.S.-China Agreement on Cooperation in Science and Technology, its official name, or STA for short, might expire if the anti-China crowd in Congress wins its argument that China will not respect intellectual property rights and will use collaborative research to support its military. Supporters of the STA acknowledge that cooperation can be abused, but point to the greater benefits. These include the window provided into Chinese research and the opportunity to engage the Chinese on U.S. concerns. The agreement has helped China transition from ozone-depleting CFCs and enabled the sharing of influenza data used to devise yearly vaccines. It has also facilitated data sharing about satellites, climate and seismic activities, as well as fusion and subatomic particle experiments. As I've reported before, U.S.-China scientific collaboration on published research tops all other international collaborations by a wide margin, an achievement largely wiped out by the Trump administration's Justice Department's so-called China Initiative, which led thousands of Chinese scientists to return home rather than face unwarranted scrutiny over their allegiances. China seems ready to continue the SAT. An embassy spokesman in Washington said, quote, China is ready to discuss the content and form of the agreement with the U.S. on the basis of equality and mutual benefit. Harvard's Professor John Holdren, who signed the initial STA when he served as Obama's director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, agrees. The STA signing gave, he said, a form of permission for lab-to-lab, university-to-university, scientist-to-scientist cooperation. It legitimized the whole notion that collaboration was respectable. That spirit needs to be revitalized. It has served both countries well. Ukraine's diplomatic offensive. Ukraine is realizing that getting across its message to other countries is as important as gaining the advantage on the battlefield. Recently, Ukraine co-hosted an international conference with Saudi Arabia, attended by about 40 countries. Russia wasn't invited, but the other members of the so-called BRICS group, China, India, South Africa, and Brazil, did attend. Ukraine's peace plan, of course, is simple: remove Russia from its territory. That's a hard sell with many developing countries that depend on Russian oil and aid. One has to wonder if the real purpose of the meeting for some of the key players wasn't image building rather than a serious search for a peaceful solution to the war. China was there as part of its active diplomacy with Saudi Arabia that has included substantial economic agreements and helped brokering Saudi engagement with Iran. Saudi Arabia's co-hosting was to demonstrate that Mohammed bin Salman is becoming a major world leader who can deal effectively with all great powers, not just with countries in his neighborhood. Likewise, Indian and Brazilian leaders have aspirations for projecting influence beyond their regions. Whether all this showboating will yield benefits for peace remains very much to be seen. Chinese students in the United Kingdom face a dilemma. In a southeast London street known as Brick Lane for its wall art, graffiti with Chinese Communist Party slogans appeared one recent day. After it got attention on social media, critics of the party responded with graffiti of their own, probably the work mainly of young Chinese from the mainland and Hong Kong. The backstory here is how Chinese dissidents, especially students abroad, are caught up in politics at home. Their dilemma is speaking critically about their home country and risking reprisals against their family. It's an all-too-common situation for Chinese students abroad. Communist Party officials warn them against speaking out, and students know very well what that warning entails. One Chinese student dissident wrote recently in a British newspaper about this censorship, describing the secrecy with which critical students must conduct their meetings and the pleas from parents back home not to engage in criticism of the party. Students well recall an incident in Manchester last year in which a student who was protesting repression in Hong Kong in front of the Chinese consulate was dragged into the consulate by the consul general himself and probably beaten while British police stood by. The student's newspaper column ends with a plea to the British government for legal and even mental health support against, quote, Communist Party intimidation and bullying. Montana students win an unprecedented environmental victory. Speaking of students, listeners may recall that back in June, several Montana students brought suit against the state for failing to take climate change into account in state projects and thus violating their right to a healthful environment. Well, they won. A district court judge ruled that even though Montana's carbon emissions are very small, they do contribute to climate issues such as drought and wildfires. Moreover, regulators must not be limited in their consideration of climate effects, a ruling of immediate consequence since Republicans support a law that would impose just such a limit. Now we await a trial here in Oregon on environmental rights that a judge has ordered, with the federal government the defendant. Ecuador, murder capital. Situated between two major cocaine-producing states, Colombia and Peru, Ecuador in recent years has been a major conduit for drugs and gang violence. Gang competition for control of the drug trade has led to riots in jails, a dramatic rise in the country's murder rate, 3,600 violent deaths so far this year, and assassinations of officials. Recently, a candidate for the presidency, Fernando Villavicencio, who was not likely to win the election, but was an outspoken critic of the drug trade and the gangs that controlled it. He paid the price. Six Colombians have been arrested, noteworthy since Colombian mercenaries were also identified as the assassins of Haiti's president, Moise, in 2021. Gangland competition, which takes place in prisons and in the streets, is a prominent feature of political life in Ecuador. In recent years, there have been dozens of prison riots and hundreds of prisoner deaths that are traceable to gangs, which are heavily armed and in easy communication with members outside prison. These gangs, in turn, are linked to Mexican cocaine cartels and to local Ecuadorian mayors and others in on the take. It's hard to sustain a semblance of democracy in such a situation. As we have seen in the Philippines under Rodrigo Duterte, one alternative is a massive crackdown on crime that mutates into gross violations of human rights. Ecuador has supporters of that approach who have ambitions for the presidency. That would pose problems for the U.S., which needs Ecuador's cooperation in dealing with the large exodus of people seeking safety and a better life in the U.S. U.S.-Iran relations have their ups and downs. One of the key obstacles to normalization of U.S.-Iran relations is prisoner release. In July, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said pessimistically, "We have not arrived at an understanding that would get the prisoners out." But now it appears they have. On August 10, an agreement was reported that will free the Americans in exchange for the release of several Iranians jailed for sanctions violations and $6 billion in withheld Iranian oil revenue. The money will be held by a bank in Qatar and can only be used by Iran to pay for basic needs such as medicine. Another positive sign is a Wall Street Journal report that Iran is significantly slowing enrichment of its uranium stockpile, keeping it below the 60% level necessary for a nuclear bomb. However, negative signs are also apparent. A U.S. buildup of ships and planes in the Persian Gulf area, with protection of oil shipments the main mission, and Iran's continued seizure of commercial ships in the Strait of Hormuz, through which about 20% of global oil passes. To sum Iran experts such as Trita Parsi at the Quincy Institute, the U.S. buildup is an irresponsible escalation. Quote, the Iranians taking some of these ships in the Gulf of Oman and the Persian Gulf is, without a doubt, a problem that needs to be addressed. But the root of this problem is that the Biden administration has continued Trump's maximum pressure strategy on Iran and has been confiscating vessels with Iranian oil, saying that this is the implementation of U.S. sanctions. But U.S. sanctions and U.S. laws do not apply to international waters. And as a result, the maritime security of the Persian Gulf has been threatened by these actions and by the response of the Iranians. If we truly want this to end, says Parsi, the easiest way is to stop confiscating the Iranian oil. And that way, there will be no reason for the Iranians to do what they have been doing. Finally, an update on Niger's crisis. Recently, a U.S. State Department official flew to Niger and met with some junta leaders in hopes of finding a negotiated way out of the current coup. But she found the junta leaders are quite firm in their view of how they want to proceed, she said. If the junta doesn't comply, she said, they may push us to the point of declaring the coup a coup, which would mean an end to U.S. military and economic aid and the end of the U.S. presence there. She also warned the junta about bringing in the Russian Wagner Group, pointing to the risks to the sovereignty of Niger. So far, the junta has been unwavering. It has rejected meeting with UN and West African groups. It has threatened to kill the imprisoned former president if an outside force intervenes against the junta. And it has insisted on diplomatic recognition as a precondition of negotiations. ECOWAS, the West African Regional Economic Bloc, has instead put a standby military force in place in hopes, presumably, of forcing the junta to step down. That seems most unlikely. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Mel Gertov. Take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. Despite official U.S. denials, The Intercept reported recently that secret Pakistan cable documents show that there was U.S. pressure to remove Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, who's now in jail, on what his supporters believe are bogus corruption charges. According to a classified Pakistani government document obtained by the online news organization, the U.S. State Department encouraged the Pakistani government in a March 7th meeting of last year to remove Khan over his neutrality on the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Abdul Jabbar is a retired professor of interdisciplinary studies at City College of San Francisco. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg.
Imran Khan was saying from the start that this was a U.S. engineered coup. Is this cable the proof of that, the definitive proof that he would need to make his case? Well, of course, the State Department is denying that that's the case, but okay.
Yeah, of course, the State Department spokesperson are trained to deny anything. Have we ever admitted that we have a regime change done anywhere? We have so many regime change operations, we never own up to it because it will be a disgrace to us. So I know Matthew Miller, he said, the things he said contradict what is in the contents. Anybody who can read English will see that it is a blatant lie. What he is trying to do is saying that the words of Mr. Liu do not suggest that we have a preference for a leader in a country. And Liu is constantly saying throughout to the ambassador that if the no confidence motion goes through against Khan, then Pakistan will have a reprieve. Otherwise, there will be dire consequences. Now, that is taking a position. I don't see the cable, the secret cable, I don't see any reason now why we shouldn't believe the content. Although everyone is afraid to speak the truth. The Department of State won't comment on it, except that they will deny. Even the embassy of Pakistan is afraid to make a comment. I don't think the ambassador who was there at that time is still the ambassador. He was removed by the new establishment. And in Pakistan, you cannot get confirmation from whom. Imran Khan is in jail in a military cell, which is disgusting that a leader who represents 80% of the people is being treated. it has been, to me, it has become like a personal vendetta between the current army chief and Imran Khan. Imran Khan didn't want that, but he's being punished for speaking the truth.
Doesn't this kind of thing go on all the time where a big country will tell a small country, look, you're going to do what we want you to do or else? Don't the European colonial powers do that? Doesn't the U.S. do that all the time, in a sense?
I think it has been the U.S. policy, but you have to also blame the host country. You cannot just blame the U.S. government. You have to have people in the home country. You know, why can't we have U.S. have a regime change in India? Modi is a terror, but we welcome him with open arms. Why? Because Indian government is not open to such intervention. So the interventions happen all the time, but there has to be someone in the home country to take advantage of that.
So what are the Pakistani leaders afraid of? I mean, that they think that the U.S. could isolate them? What's the deal there?
You're talking about the current leaders, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah,
the establishment. Yes, you know, they are dependent on the U.S. for even the military hardware. So that's why the army of Pakistan is always getting the blessings of the U.S. government before they take any step that might irritate the government. In this case, it is very unfortunate that our U.S. government inferred something totally incorrect about Imran Khan's role about going to Ukraine. Doran Liu said that it was Imran Khan's personal policy and it was not the government's policy, army's policy. So if things change and he's removed, things will be normal again. So that is, again, who is joining hands with the U.S. to make that possible? It is the general, the army chief at that time, Bajwa, and now, of course, the current army chief is carrying on that tradition. The tradition is army is sovereign. Anything other than that is a lie. If I were to say that, that there is a sovereignty belonging to the Constitution, in principle may be right, but in practice it never happens.
Didn't the U.S. object to Imran Khan before he went to Moscow? Weren't they against him as soon as he started running for office?
In fact, you are right that there were a few things, such as he had made statements during his campaign speeches that he would like to have an independent Pakistan, not playing to the tune of any power. He didn't favor China or Russia over U.S. He just said he would do what is best for his country first. And then he said, we are allies with everyone in peace, but not in war. And he made very open statements in the campaign that he would like to bring this war on terror to an end because it has cost Pakistan over $1 billion and 80,000 lives. He kept saying that repeatedly. At one time, Trump, when he was president, he said Pakistan had not done enough. And Imran Khan retaliated right away that, look, we have sacrificed 80,000 people, over $1 billion loss. How can you say that? You know. Then Trump invited him. Actually, you may know he was treated royally, Imran Khan, in the White House by Trump. And Trump begged him, literally, to extricate us from Afghanistan. And even offered to negotiate between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. So when Biden became president, he totally was different. He never acknowledged Imran Khan as prime minister. He never engaged. The department didn't engage. State Department didn't engage with Pakistan, even though we did that with everyone else in the world. And what was the reason? Well, he had also said, Imran Khan, before his election, he will not allow any bases, military bases in Pakistan. And that didn't go well with our government. And so all these things were there before he was elected. And we should be very honest that he was elected because of the army. How? The army didn't help him in votes. It didn't prevent people from voting for him. That was the role of the army, because that's what the army does. It prevents people from voting for a certain person. And it has been going on for ages. And I'm afraid if any election is held, first of all, there will be no election because Imran Khan will win. And the army doesn't want it. The US government doesn't want it. And the current coalition called PDM, ironically called Pakistan Democratic Movement, it is opposed to elections. So they don't want Imran Khan to win. And his party members, 10,000, are in jail. And
10,000, you say?
10,000 are in jail. And the top leadership, they are one very prominent journalist, Imran Riaz, was kidnapped on May 9th. And he has been missing since then. His children, family. And then one was murdered. I don't know if you know, very prominent journalist of Pakistan, Arshad Sharif. He had to flee the country because he was covering this cable, secret cable, openly and trying to speak the truth. Then he fled the country. He went to Nairobi in Kenya. He was murdered there. Just imagine that. So some journalists have been arrested, still are in jail. Some have been murdered. So in this climate, you can't expect anything good to come out.
The two families that have been so dominant in Pakistani politics, is that still true? It's the Bhuttos and I can't think of the other.
Nawaz Sharif party, which is Muslim League. Nawaz Sharif is somebody who was the prime minister at one time. And there was a leak, Panama Papers, and he was accused and then convicted of money laundering in that case. He was in prison when he asked for some reprieve to go to London for treatment. Imran Khan was then the prime minister. He let him go. He didn't prevent him from going to treatment. And he has been engineering these machinations from London. He is much more powerful than any person else I can think of in Pakistan in the civilian arena. Of course, military is all powerful, and the current military chief is the sovereign of that country. And the other party, Zardari Bhutto, he bankrolls, he has so much money that he's the one who was responsible for buying out some of the members of Imran Khan's party to make the no confidence pass. He gave millions of dollars to people, and then those people received the dollars, walked over to against the party Imran Khan, and then they left the country because they couldn't live in that country anymore. People would not let them live. And someone went to Turkey and the other, I don't know where they went. So he's the bankrolling billionaire who makes these things possible. At this time, though, he is not very happy with Nawaz Sharif because he wants election, because his party will get some votes. And Muslim League Party, Nawaz Sharif Party, is not like to get much, even less than the Zardari and Bhutto family. And so they don't want any, they want elections, Bhutto, Zardari, Nawaz Sharif will only want elections when Imran Khan has been either totally eliminated or his party can no longer win the election.
I remember for a while, it seemed like years ago, Benazir Bhutto had an image as someone who was a reformer, but I don't know how true that was. Maybe it was partially true, I don't know.
It was partly true. She was rendered incapable of making changes, even in women's rights, because, you know, we hope that she's a woman prime minister, the first one at that time, probably in the Muslim world, Muslim country, and that she would make changes. But, you know, she couldn't go against the dictates of the establishment. So whatever she did was very little. She couldn't do much. And the worst thing that she did was that Zardari, everybody knows in Pakistan, Zardari got her brother murdered. Her brother was getting very popular, running against his sister Benazir to be the next PM. He was very popular. And so Zardari arranged, of course, nobody will say it is, nobody will be able to prove it, but 99% people in Pakistan know that, that he got the brother killed in a police stop. And then these things were tried on Imran also. Luckily, he escaped. So far, he escaped because of the people behind him. There may be a revolution if they kill him now. That's the only reason he's alive.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
The only benefit I see of the revelation of the Intercept attempt to unravel this secret document, the only benefit is that we now know what we suspected. But I don't think it will change anything in Pakistan, because the US government doesn't want anything to be changed in Pakistan. They want one person in Pakistan responsible to the US. We don't want democracy, because that's a mess. We have to go through the parliamentary decisions and all that. So the US government, as long as we don't pressure our government to align with democracy, nothing will change. There is a member, Texas Democrat, Cesar. He tried to introduce on the House floor a motion that we should be concerned about the backsliding of democracy in Pakistan. It was not even put to vote. Even our Congress is really complicit in what is happening. It's a tragedy. Pakistan was very prosperous under Imran Khan, 7% growth, and a lot of welfare work was being done, healthcare was being done, and then this is really a huge tragedy that the US government has perpetrated on the people of Pakistan. What can I say more than that?
Yeah, they tend to, the US tends to pick and choose which democratic backsliding it wants to emphasize.
Exactly. Democracy has to be on our terms.
Yeah.
We did the same thing in Palestine. Our government kept saying,